Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Dennis Goldford and Donna Hoffman. Today, our analysts, both professors of political science at their respective universities. Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, and Donna Hoffman at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, Dennis, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
We have a lot to get to, as is the case usually here later in the program, with another candidate. I think this is now 3 Democratic candidates entering the contest. We're going to talk about the Democrats' chances of unseating U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. And we'll continue our caucus series with a home state view of Amy Klobuchar by talking with a longtime journalist at Minnesota Public Radio. He's been covering Amy Klobuchar's career, her rise from the 1990s on. So that's yet to come in the coming minutes of this hour. But first of all, let's talk about that visit we heard about in NPR's news. President Trump winding up his visit to the United Kingdom and Ireland. Tomorrow he'll be in France to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day. It was yesterday that the president said he believed Britain would leave the European Union even if it failed to make a deal with Brussels by the October 31st deadline. He spoke of, in his word, a phenomenal trade deal with the U.S. We had protesters. They brought back that Trump baby balloon with a cell phone and diapers and tried to bring central London to a standstill yesterday. Let's hear a little bit of the president at a news conference without going UK Prime Minister Theresa May. President Trump weighing in on who should succeed her, blasting critics, including the mayor of London, and said he hadn't seen any sign of protests during his visit.
And then I heard that there were protests. I said, where are the protests? I don't see any protests. I did see a small protest today when I came, very small. So a lot of it is fake news, I hate to say. But you saw the people waving the American flag, waving your flag. It was tremendous spirit and love. There was great love. It was an alliance.
The leader of the left-leaning Labour Party in Britain, Jeremy Corbyn, spoke to protesters while the news conference was happening and had this to say.
So I say to our visitors that have arrived this week, think on, please, about a world that is one of peace and disarmament, is one of recognizing the values of all people, is a world that defeats racism, defeats misogyny, defeats the religious hatreds that are being fueled by the far right in politics, in Britain, in Europe, and the United States.
Let me turn to you, Donna Hoffman, first of all. How do you think this visit has gone? A lot of controversy there.
A lot of controversy, but maybe, I don't know, maybe we've gotten used to the controversy that kind of surrounds Trump as he travels abroad.
Right.
You know, you can compare this to his, not a state visit, but a visit earlier in 2018 that also drew a lot of protesters, apparently a few more. The estimate I've seen of those protests were about 100,000. This one is about 75,000. And, you know, Trump did some controversial things, but I think, in my perspective, they were really kind of blips on the radar. They got comment. The dust up with Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, is something that's kind of ongoing. Theresa May, of course, is on her way out as prime minister, and they're wrestling with the Brexit deal or no deal. And, you know, so part of what happened then at the press conference between Trump and Theresa May was, you know, what kind of bilateral negotiations might we then enter into with the UK? But we can't even do that until they're out officially of the European Union. So, you know, again, some kind of, I guess, normal dramatics that you have with Trump. But again, I think not just people in the United States, but even some of the people abroad may have gotten used to kind of the chaos that surrounds the president as he does these kinds of events. And they take them into consideration and then they move on.
Mm. Dennis, do you have a different view?
No, it's pretty much the same. The abnormal has become the new normal, I think, with regard to the president, excuse me, and the way he conducts himself. This visit, of course, has a lot to do with the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and it's purely ceremonial. The president, of course, does his the new normal of the kind of Twitter spats we see with the mayor of London and others. He had the press conference with Prime Minister May, with whom he was not, or toward whom he was not very respectful at times over the past year or two. But this shows that the relationship with Great Britain, even though in some ways it's under some strain now, is bigger than and more important than any particular leader of either side at the time.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, give us your thoughts, since you're at that point. Donald Trump speaking of this, quote, phenomenal trade deal between the UK and the US. I don't think we've heard any details on that. So do you see a master plan here, peeling the UK? I mean, he's a Brexiteer, if we can say that, peeling the UK away from continental Europe, being a closer trade ally with the U.S. Is that the scheme?
Well, I've seen nothing to indicate any master plan or phenomenal trade deal at this point. Remember, the president talks with a great deal of hyperbole. It's part of being a salesman in some ways. Moderation, subtlety tends not to be part of his repertoire. And that hyperbole, he called it once in one of his books, truthful hyperbole, as he called it, in the way of talking about potential agreements or deals or contracts or whatever he's dealing with. But there was always considered to be a special relationship between the U.S. and Great Britain, at least since they left the burning White House in 1812. But since then, there's always been a special relationship between the U.S. and Great Britain. And the president, of course, has spoken disparagingly of NATO, and the U.S., Great Britain, and Germany, of course, are core elements of that alliance. And he's spoken of NATO as if it were a trade association in certain ways, or a protection racket wanting more money from them to support the U.S. contribution. But above and beyond all of that, this abnormal new normal, again, there's this cornerstone of American diplomacy, which is being very tightly tied with Great Britain. Other than some elements of controversy during the Iraq War, the last really significant spat between the U.S. and Great Britain was with the Suez Canal in, 1956, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
But still, this is the cornerstone of our foreign policy, this alliance with Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has called this special relationship with Britain a very big and important alliance. Donna, do you get the sense he really feels that way? Is he trying to reshape this relationship?
Well, I mean, I think, I agree with Dennis in terms of how he approaches these things. He's not a detail person. That special relationship goes back, to the end of World War II, in particular, being given articulation anyway by Churchill. But, you know, one of the things that yet again we see him doing that's abnormal is wading into domestic politics in the UK. And so in this press conference with Theresa May, for example, he weighed into the National Health Service, which actually was started by our ambassador, talking about how that was potentially on the table in any kind of bilateral trade negotiation, which then apparently later in an interview that ran yesterday or maybe this morning, he walked that back. And so the special relationship doesn't mean that we meddle in domestic affairs of the UK, but we are walking up to that a little bit. He also talked about some of the candidates who are vying within the Conservative Party to succeed Theresa May, and gave some support for a couple of those people. And that's also typically something that we don't see another head of state doing in talking on these kinds of relationships. And so that special relationship, again, still really important. But like Dennis said, it apparently is going to survive some of the nicks that I think it's been getting lately.
Mm-hmm. Back briefly before we move on to both of your comments about this being the new normal, the chaos that surrounds the president wherever he goes. And also, it's significant that this is almost a footnote when I mentioned this at the very end of this conversation, that we have a president who says, "I don't see any protests," and calls the demonstrations fake news, when clearly we have a photographic video evidence on our news. There are 75,000 thereabouts in his vicinity. Dennis, that's just something we take with his presidency as well.
Well, you might recall my saying somewhat facetiously that the president is a Marxist, but I don't mean Karl, I mean Chico. Chico Marx, of course, had that great line in, I believe it was Duck Soup, "Who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?" And that's what we have with the president, sort of daring people to question their own ability to see and hear various things, like the comments about Meghan Markle being nasty, that sort of thing. It was right there. You can see the quote. You can hear the words come out of the president's mouth, and he denies ever saying that. And, you know, there's the old argument from someone who was rather unsavory, I won't mention in German history, but said that, you know, if you repeat the big lie long enough and often enough, people will believe it. Now, talking about Meghan Markle as nasty is not a big lie or anything like that. But again, the president tries to shape the reality that suits him and wants to get everybody else to buy into that particular picture. Many people do that. Others are very critical of that. And of course, it's dependent upon your particular partisan orientation.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, both professors of political science at their respective universities. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Let's talk about these tariffs. The president has vowed to use broad emergency powers to impose a 5% tariff beginning this coming Monday and to increase that rate to 25% incrementally by October if Mexico doesn't stem the flow of migrants to the U.S. Now we're hearing how senators are almost uniformly opposed to the president's plans to tax Mexican imports. Lawmakers saying it would be the president saying that lawmakers would be foolish to try to stop him. Senator Cruz, we heard in our news, a Republican of Texas, "You didn't hear a single yes," warned Senator Cruz. Well, let's hear President Trump lay out his plans for increasing tariffs on Mexican goods unless the government does more to stop the flow of migrants and refugees across the U.S. border.
And every month those tariffs go from 5% to 10% to 15% to 20% and then to 25%. And what will happen then is all of those companies that have left our country and gone to Mexico are going to be coming back to us. And that's okay.
But the president is finding little support for his plan in the GOP-controlled U.S. Senate. Iowa's U.S. Senator Charles Grassley was asked about whether the Senate might approve a resolution of disapproval of the president's tariffs and did not dismiss the idea.
There's some disagreement even among Republicans whether a resolution of disapproval would be appropriate in this place. And right now it's speculation because the president would have to actually issue an executive order, which he hasn't done yet, before that would be even a consideration. But I think we better get a legal answer to your question.
Donna Hoffman, let me start with you. What are we seeing here? Is it something we haven't seen before in terms of congressional Republicans standing in opposition to the president with more than just words, but possible actions?
Well, a little bit. I think maybe in terms of degrees, but even Grassley himself was quoted in a Des Moines Register story today as saying that if it came down to a vote that would essentially block the implementation of the tariffs by blocking this national emergency, that he would institute them under, said he wasn't sure how he would vote. So Rubio came out with a tweet that was essentially in support of the president in terms of this. And so there is a little bit of pushback, I think more pushback, more public pushback than we have seen on many issues. But in part, it is kind of bound up in a negotiation in terms of positioning the Senate and trying to get the president to reconsider the virtue of going forward with policies like this, signaling that there's some opposition, signaling that the opposition might be strong. And so there is a back and forth, I would say, behind the scenes going forward, that in which Republicans are legitimately saying to the president, this is not the best course of policy that we think we should have going forward in this area. And Trump is, you know, not apparently, from what I'm reading, coming back on any of those kinds of threats at all at this point.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what can Republicans actually do? They would what? Need a veto-proof vote. I wonder, I guess, is that in question, whether they could muster that?
Of course it is. Republicans have been loath to contradict the president, to put up a fight against particular programs or ideas of his. What makes this particular one more noticeable is that there is some pushback against this idea, because remember what a tariff does. It makes it more, if you put a tariff on item X from country Y, it makes it more expensive for Americans to buy that product. Now, what it does is potentially reduce sales from that other country. It enables domestic producers of the same product to raise their prices to that level, yet still be somewhat below that. But it's the American consumer that pays that price. The foreign company may buy, may sell fewer items in America. The problem for farm state senators and others in manufacturing areas is if Mexico or some other country in the same situation puts up a corresponding tariff, it makes it harder to sell soybeans or corn or anything like that abroad. This is why Republicans have always been in favor of free trade and opposed tariffs, and how the president contradicts that Republican orthodoxy.
Let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Dennis Goldberg and Donna Hoffman on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Ira is joining us from Des Moines. Hi, Ira. Coming up on a break.
Hi.
We love having you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it a lot. Question I'd like to ask to Dennis Goldberg was, when you were talking about and frankly prevaricating on the president's use of alternate realities and things, let's face it, if you or I were to do the same thing in creating accounts of reality that wasn't there, then our sanity would be questioned, and justifiably so. How come the news media and other observers who should really know better are so hesitant to say the same thing about someone who is exhibiting the same kind of behavior? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Ira in Des Moines. Thank you. Dennis.
I know who Ira is. You have had the actual fact that whether it's the fact checkers and you see in the Washington Post and other areas, you do have various news outlets coming back and saying, well, no, this actually didn't happen. You know, this starts at least back with the crowd size at the president's inauguration. But again, you're always in a difficult circumstance, because if you're a politician, to a great extent, you live in a black and white world. If you're not for us, you're against us. If you're against us, you're not for us, and so forth. When you're trying to be someone, whether as an analyst or a member of the news media, to be a reporter on what's going on, it's trickier, because on the one hand, you got to say, yes, in fact, the crowd was a lot smaller than the president claimed, or what the president claimed about some other situation was not true. On the other hand, you can't become part of the story yourself. And that's where, when you've got somebody willing to dare news media or analysts to say he's wrong, has the upper hand, because they're playing on a field with a disadvantage toward the people who are trying to maintain some sense of objectivity. Mm-hmm. That's been the difficulty in dealing with this administration.
Mm-hmm. And I have to remark to Ira, I hope Ira is very satisfied with NPR and IPR's coverage here. We make it a point to, where reality does not meet the rhetoric, we make it a point, regardless of who's talking, to point that out. That's one of the parts of our mission, and we do it regularly with this president. Let's talk quickly before the break about the visit next week by the president to Iowa. It will include a tour of a renewable energy facility in Council Bluffs, where the president will highlight his administration's approval of year-round access to gasoline with higher blends of ethanol. Also next week, on Tuesday, he will visit West Des Moines for a fundraiser for the Republican Party of Iowa. Donna, to you, how does this president sit with Iowa at the current time in terms of approval here?
Well, he's been underwater, as we would call it, for quite some time, whereas there are more people that disapprove of him than approve. The latest Iowa poll, I think, was about 50% disapproved of him, if memory serves. But regardless of that factor, Iowa is very much in a scheme to be reelected for the president. And so this is probably the first of several visits that we will see before the 2020 election, because even though Iowa has relatively few electoral votes, he did win them in 16. And in doing the Electoral College math, Iowa will once again be in play, it looks like, and may be important to his strategy in that regard.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a March Des Moines Register, MediaCom, CNN, Iowa poll finding that 81% of registered Republicans approved of the job President Trump is doing. That's the same level of approval as in December of 2018. That's so March of this year compared with December of last year. Just 12% of Iowa Republicans disapproving of the job he's doing. Dennis, any words to explain the high approval, the split, I guess, the deep partisan divide over his job performance?
Well, the president, of course, as Donna noted quite accurately, won in 2016, won the state of Iowa, could well do it again in 2020. I've always maintained that 2016 was, in a way, the revenge of rural and small-town America against urban America. And in fact, in Iowa, if you look at or if you exclude the six biggest counties in terms of voting turnout, Polk, Johnson, Dubuque, Blackhawk, Lynn, and Scott, if you take those out of the mix, we saw this in the governor's race last November. Republicans win a majority of the vote in the other 93 counties, and they're the more rural counties, generally speaking. And the president has maintained substantial support in those rural areas. They're concerned about the question of tariffs and trade wars and the effect upon agricultural exports and things like that. But at the same time, they believe that the president has stood up for them and their values and has not, in their view, condescended to them the way they think somebody like Hillary Clinton did, whether any of that's accurate or not. Those are the perceptions. So unless something significant happens with regard to the agricultural market spread, if things collapse or something, unless that sort of happens, I would expect him to maintain significant support in these more rural, small-town Republican areas.
Mm-hmm. And we have to stress, too, don't we, that the federal government will spend $16 billion in a second round of trade aid to offset the losses that the farmers here in Iowa and across the U.S. have experienced from these trade disputes. That comes on top of a $12 billion trade aid provided last year.
So this is what gives conventional Republicans heartburn, because, again, you have the president basically interfering in the marketplace. And for Republicans, that's not what government is supposed to do.
We'll be back in just a moment with Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. It's Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll get a home state view of Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota as one of the Democratic presidential candidates. I'll be talking with Mark Zadeklik. Mark Zadeklik, a correspondent with Minnesota Public Radio. When we come back, a home state view of Amy Klobuchar. It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with Dennis Goldford and Donna Hoffman in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Donna Hoffman and Dennis Goldford, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Dennis of Drake University. We're going to ask them for a few minutes to sit on the sidelines and listen for a few minutes before we continue our discussion with them. And we continue our series of short conversations, our Home State View series, in which we focus on the individual Democratic presidential candidates by talking with someone in the media from their home state who's been covering them for some time. We've already heard home state perspectives about Kirsten Gillibrand, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, and Cory Booker. Today, a home state perspective on U.S. Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. Joining us to do that, Mark Zadeklik. He's a correspondent with Minnesota Public Radio. Mark, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
How long have you been covering Amy Klobuchar?
since she was the Hennepin County attorney in the late 1990s, so I've been around her for a very long time.
Okay, good. We're glad you have this long view for us of her career. Tell us about her leadership style in Minnesota, what she's known for.
She's known to be a very hard worker. She makes a point of visiting all 87 Minnesota counties every year. She's also known for being kind of a moderate person who holds her cards kind of close to the vest and is not likely to, jump out and say dramatic things. She's known as someone who presents herself as someone who likes to work across the aisle, kind of likes to frame herself as a common sense politician who just wants to do what's going to help the people she represents.
Mm, and also interested to see, like Kamala Harris, she has a background in criminal justice.
She does. She was elected Hennepin County Attorney in 1998. That's the county where Minneapolis is located. She, like many county attorneys at the time, worked to crack down on petty crimes like vandalism in hopes of reducing more serious crimes. She had some run-ins with the union that represented employees in the county attorney office. They accused her of creating a hostile workplace and claimed she treated people inappropriately. They even tried to block her endorsement for Senate when she decided to run for Senate in 2006, but they were unsuccessful at that. She's drawn criticism after the fact for her time as county attorney for not bringing charges in more than two dozen deadly police shooting cases, and also for not prosecuting as many police brutality cases as some people think she should have. But what she was doing at the time is very much in keeping with what was going on all over the country to try to crack down on crime.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how she has distinguished herself in the Senate to Minnesotans.
Well, really kind of on bread and butter issues. A lot of consumer protection legislation, for example. She votes with her party almost all the time, but she also presents herself, as I said, as someone who likes to work across the aisle and someone who can work across the aisle. She basically just presents herself as a common sense politician that is not by any means an extremist or anything like that. And that sets her apart, in arguably, from some of the other Democrats vying for the nomination who support the Green New Deal immediately. Senator Klobuchar calls that aspirational. She does not stand out in front calling for Medicare for all. And she also says that the country can't give everybody free four-year college. She talks about free two-year community college.
And, Mark, as we know, electability is a huge part of the Democrats' focus this time around in this presidential election year to come. Electability is something that Amy Klobuchar has put at the center of her campaign, too, isn't it?
She has put that at the center of her campaign, and she has a good argument to make. She was elected in 2006 with a 20% margin and reelected with another healthy margin again in 2012. In this last election in 2018, she won by 24 points and percentage points, and she took every congressional district, including districts in Minnesota, that went for Donald Trump. And that is an argument she's making as she campaigns for president, that she can win the support not only of Democrats, but also of independents and even moderate Republicans. That is a key selling point that she brings up over and over as she campaigns.
Mm-hmm. I have to bring up a point that you find in a lot of reports, some reporting, that she is a, well, difficult person to work for. Fill us in on what that means from your perspective, as far as you can tell.
Well, around the time she rolled out her campaign in February, stories started coming out quoting unnamed staffers, saying that she was very difficult to work with, that she didn't treat people well. She knew this was coming. I knew it was coming. I could never get anybody on the record to give me their name and tell me these things, so that's why we didn't do any reporting on it. I mean, we did reporting, but we didn't put anything on the radio. For her part, she's acknowledged it head-on and maintained that she has a high expectations of herself and also very high expectations of her staff, and she's just said point-blank that she's a tough boss. It's interesting when I talk to voters about this, most all of the time, people just kind of roll their eyes and say they have no problem with that, and then it almost gives her a little more street cred because they feel like she has a backbone.
Right. Some would say, well, a hard-nosed politician in my corner, I don't care. That sounds good.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about her background, because, of course, when she's campaigning here in Iowa, she has not only urban areas, but also rural areas. And she kind of tries to straddle that, doesn't she?
She absolutely does. She grew up kind of in the outer suburbs of the Twin Cities and talks on the campaign trail about how she was kind of between the metro area and rural areas. She talks about milking a cow, for example, with one of her friends. Her relatives come from northeastern Minnesota, which is a blue-collar mining area of the state. She talks a lot about those basic, simple roots. She decided to get into politics when she was a young corporate attorney, and her daughter Abigail was born. Abigail had some serious health complications, but nonetheless, Amy Klobuchar was told she had to leave the hospital after 24 hours. She ended up soon thereafter at the Minnesota legislature and lobbied successfully for a law that allows new mothers at least 48 hours of care in the hospital if they want that. So that was kind of her foray into politics. From there, it was to the county attorney's office a few years later and then into the U.S. Senate, and now she hopes into the White House.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, we have just a few seconds left, Mark. You've been with her so many years, covering her so many years. What's she like as a campaigner when she's in a room or a hall trying to win over voters?
She's smart. She's good. And I've been around a lot of candidates. I've been doing this more than 30 years. She'll walk into a room and very purposely name the people that need to be named and point them out and kind of prop them up, the power brokers and that kind of thing. She looks people in the eye when she talks to them. She will talk to anyone who walks up to her, basically, and listen. And she's very personable and doesn't feel at all like some politicians, like it's almost like they don't want to get dirty in the crowd or whatever. But she doesn't have any pretense about her whatsoever and is very pleasant, just kind of a normal type person when she's campaigning. And, you know, arguably that's who she is.
Mark Zdechlik, thank you so much for this Home State View. You're a correspondent with Minnesota Public Radio who's been covering Amy Klobuchar since way back in the 90s. We appreciate this long view, Home State View, of your Senator Klobuchar.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me, and I'll see you in Iowa.
All right. Well, let's pivot back to Dennis Goldford and Donna Hoffman, our political analysts from Drake and the University of Northern Iowa there. Before we move on, reaction to Amy Klobuchar's candidacy or anything that you heard there, Dennis?
Well, Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar, was very impressive, I think, at the Kavanaugh hearings. Many people, if not most people, hadn't seen her in action in full prosecutorial mode. Kamala Harris was similarly very impressive in those particular settings. But I think Klobuchar is trying to occupy what pundits tend to call now that more centrist lane, that more moderate lane, as opposed to the distinctly progressive lane that you see other candidates occupying. I think in a way she seems to be trying to be the tortoise with a lot of hares running around her at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Donna, your read on Klobuchar?
So, you know, a couple of things to note. I remember, you know, pretty distinctly when she announced, along with the Kavanaugh hearings that got her a lot of notoriety, as Dennis mentioned, when she announced her run for president, she did it outside in Minnesota, and I forget the month, but it was snowing buckets.
And her hair was full of snow.
It was, and it went on.
Nice scene.
It was, and it went on, and, you know, people not from this area of the country thought that was kind of astounding, I suppose. But, you know, it kind of plays into that normal, everyday toughness that the reporter from Minnesota Public Radio was talking about she likes to exhibit. But one thing I would add, because there have been those stories that you talked about regarding her kind of leadership style, her style within her office. And, you know, one of the things I always think about those types of stories is those are characteristics that may be being talked about because she's a female candidate. So would we have those same kinds of stories for male politicians doing the same kinds of things? Because we know those are male politicians out there who are that kind of manager. And I don't think that we get those kinds of stories typically. So she obviously is in this very crowded field. She has to distinguish herself in some kind of way. And it remains to be seen exactly how she's going to do that from that centrist line that Dennis mentioned.
Let's broaden this out to the 2020 candidates in the Democratic Party. There are so many of them, and I'll just mention that this coming Sunday in Cedar Rapids, it's the Hall of Fame celebration featuring 19, yes, I said 19 of the Democratic presidential hopefuls. It's an event that sold out. Yesterday, the AARP and the Des Moines Register together announced that 20 Democratic presidential candidates will speak at their caucus forums across Iowa over 5 days in July. The forum is moderated by the Register's opinion editor, Kathy Obradovich, also Radio Iowa news director Kay Henderson. Those forums focusing on older Iowans' concerns in particular. Dennis, what are you seeing so far, broadly speaking, in this large field of candidates? What has caught your eye or your ear?
The inability of anybody at this particular point to break out and establish himself or herself as something new and unique. The difficulty, of course, in a field this large, but even in a field of a half a dozen, is to distinguish yourself. You know, who am I? How am I different from my competitors? Whose support and supporters you will need if you win the nomination, so you can't go too negative in that regard. And why am I better situated to beat the opposing candidate than everybody else? This particular event in Cedar Rapids, I might say, reminds me of the Ames Republicans' Ames straw poll, except it's not an Ames and it's not a straw poll. Well, what's the similarity? It's an organizational event. They get this brief time on stage. I believe people have to pay to get in, but campaigns may well cover that cost for some people. I'm not sure at this point. But it's a similar kind of event, which is it's kind of a cattle show in which potential candidates or actual candidates show up and audition for potentially becoming the nominee.
Mm-hmm. Your read on what's going on in the big picture with 2020 candidates, Donna?
You know, it's there are so many candidates that, you know, at these kinds of large events where you're going to have large numbers of the candidates showing up, the challenge for them is to distinguish themselves in some way. And that can be done by giving a particularly good performance, you know, or it can be done by saying something very provocative. Some people will have that strategy. Some people may have the strategy to be the last candidate standing as a food fight maybe goes on. So that's the real challenge in this very large field, is how do you get more than just kind of a cursory look of Iowa caucus goers? How do you start to build some momentum that you can parlay into organization in the state, that you can parlay into attendance at the caucuses in February?
Right. It really is interesting, this Cedar Rapids event, giving each candidate 5 minutes. If you total that up after 19 of them, that's 95 minutes. We're almost sitting through a feature-length film, 5 minutes at a time. How, Dennis, how do you expect this field of candidates to winnow in the coming months? Will we, for instance, have two dozen candidates by the time the Iowa caucuses roll around in 2020 in February?
Well, I would expect by the time of the state fair, the field will have shrunk somewhat, subject to two caveats that I just don't know the answer to at this point. Maybe Donna can help us in this regard. Number one, if the field does remain larger, significantly larger than normal, maybe some of the candidates will play for second place, so to speak, in the sense of thinking, given the number of people, I don't need to have that much of a caucus vote, however we express it with state delegate equivalents, in order to finish in the top three. The more fractured the field is, the easier it might be to finish well, even if you don't have a lot of the vote. And the other factor, whose impact I don't know yet, is with the change in funding going through social media to a great extent and the increased reliance upon small donors, typically one big reason you get out is you can't raise money to keep going anymore. Campaign money is like gasoline for the car. You can't drive it without the gasoline. You can't run a campaign without money. If these folks are able through social media to maintain, even if small, but a steady supply of campaign funding, maybe they, again, in this regard, will be able to stay in longer than normal.
Okay. Let's quickly, in the last 5 minutes, pivot over to talking about the U.S. Senate race. Senator Joni Ernst defending her seat in 2020, first elected in 2014. On Monday, Democrat Teresa Greenfield launched her bid to unseat Joni Ernst. She casts herself as, in her words, a proud farm kid with farm kid values. She runs a small business. In a video announcing her candidacy for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate, Teresa Greenfield played up her farm roots and took aim at the Republican senator, her promise in the last campaign to make big spenders in Washington, D.C. squeal.
And I know firsthand, you don't stop giving people a hand up so you can give a hand out to the super wealthy and the special interests. In Iowa, whether you live in a small town or a big city, we're all getting the short end of that stick. Joni Ernst said she'd be different.
Washington's full of big spenders. Let's make them squeal.
Listen, folks, she didn't castrate anyone. She cast her vote to let the corporate lobbyists keep feasting like hogs at the trough.
Now, Greenfield is the third Democrat to jump into this race to challenge Ernst, joining businessman Eddie Morrow and lawyer Kimberly Graham. I guess Democrats seeing this as a prime opportunity to chip into the Republicans' 53-47 Senate majority. Donna Hoffman, how vulnerable would you say Senator Ernst is?
Well, any senator running, or any House member even, running for their first reelection is generally seen as being the most vulnerable they'll be in their career, barring some kind of scandal. And so this is, you know, Joni Ernst's first reelection campaign. And she now has a record that she has to justify that she can run on. Those can be both positive and negative. And you already see Teresa Greenfield in that clip that you played trying to match her in terms of farm credibility, rural voter credibility, but also then touching upon the record that she had. She said in a campaign she would make them squeal. She hasn't done that. I can do that because I have a similar type of background. And so we would expect that kind of dialogue probably, you know, to go on. Teresa Greenfield, also a female candidate. You have another female candidate in the race, as you mentioned. Joni Ernst has the added qualification there of her military service. And so there's going to be this back and forth between these candidates on the Democratic side vying for the nomination as to who best can take on Joni Ernst, and that's part of the message that you're hearing Teresa Greenfield start to make right now.
Maybe you both have been looking at different polls. I'm seeing one here, February Des Moines Register poll, finding 57% of Iowans approve of the job Joni Ernst is doing, her highest mark so far. Anything over 50%, Dennis, correct me if I'm wrong, that's a pretty strong showing.
Oh, yeah, she's in very good shape. But I think, as Donna said, it's that sophomore election, that first reelection bid, that's the most vulnerable point for a new member, a first-year member of the House or the Senate. In 2014, with Bruce Braley's help, Joni Ernst was able to paint Braley as the big city slicker lawyer and herself as the good, rural, well-grounded, well-valued small-town Iowan. And I think what Teresa Greenfield is trying to do is to occupy some of that good, solid, small-town Iowa landscape.
Mm-hmm. We have a minute or so, 2 minutes left. Let me go out with this question for you. Tomorrow, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the Allied invasion of Nazi-occupied Europe, arguably the most significant day in the 20th century. Tomorrow, I'm going to be talking on this program with journalist Alex Kershaw. He's had a lot of history researched and written about this. He has a book out called The First Wave about the D-Day warriors, those first hours. Given almost everything about this president is unconventional, including his relationship with NATO, with Europe, conclude with a few brief thoughts about how this, about this president helping to commemorate the Normandy landings. Donna.
Well, for him not to be there, for him not to celebrate this, you know, this is, again, the 75th anniversary. That's a big anniversary. For him not to be there would be highly unusual. But at the same time, you know, this is the last big anniversary in which we expect to have actual veterans who were there. Mm-hmm. Because they're aging out, essentially. So for the next, you know, 80th anniversary, for example, there will be relatively few that would still be living. So for Trump not to be there, for Trump not to celebrate with the other heads of the allied nations in particular, would be highly unusual. Again, you know, earlier today, he was at Portsmouth in England, also celebrating this a little bit more low-key celebration, I believe, but was relatively low-key, as I understand it, nothing controversial happening at that. And that's what I would expect. This will be a very ceremonial, highly scripted event, I would expect.
Dennis, 30 seconds for you on the way out.
The problem for the president is that when he's highly scripted, he's not at his best. He's best off the cuff, even if he says wildly questionable things. He's not a Ronald Reagan. Few people are. Reagan gave this wonderful, stirring speech in 1984 commemorating the 40th anniversary. Almost nobody could stand up against that, and certainly President Trump won't be able to.
Okay, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Dennis and Donna, thank you so much for an hour full of insights. We appreciate it.
You bet.
Happy to be here.
Once again, tomorrow on the program, I'll talk with Alex Kershaw, New York Times bestselling author, journalist. His latest book, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. Also, we'll listen back. We dug back in the archives to a conversation I had with an Iowan, George Dane. He's since passed away. He passed away last year. I had a conversation with him in 2015. He was involved in the Battle of the Bulge, which, of course, did follow D-Day some months later. That's tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Help today also from Camus Leeson. We always welcome your comments and questions. Email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.